I love strategy, being able to use any of that with our team, again, in this delivery of cancer care and being able to move faster to get that to patients. I love how those worlds merge. If you don't have people that believe in what you're doing, then it's all for naught.
Hey, it's Nate DeSaro, and welcome to Titans of Industry, the podcast where I talk to industry leaders and innovators who are at the top of their game and leading the pack in their fields, uncovering some of the best stories in today's business landscape. In today's episode, I sit down with Adam Head, a genuinely great guy and phenomenal leader, but also the president and CEO of Cartai Cancer Center. Adam tells us how he has brought his military leadership principles into today's crisis management, how having trust within your team is vital to creating a culture that can overcome just about anything, and how he and his team are living out the vision to create the best cancer care in the country. Now let's get to the episode. But before we do, it's important to know that whether you're a small business owner or the face of a multi-billion dollar industry, your organization has a great story to tell, and Content Titan wants to help you tell it. We are a digital content creation powerhouse built for the 21st century, providing all-in creative, strategic, production, post-production, and distribution services for a 360-degree, 24/7 world. In our world, Titans are passionate, creative doers. They have the experience to take your project from start to finish, minimizing your involvement so you can focus on what matters most, running your business. So if you're ready to take your content strategy and production to the next level, our Titans are ready to help. Now here's my conversation with Adam Head.
Well, Adam, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Appreciate you having me.
Being on the podcast. I know a little bit about your background, but not a lot. So I'd love for you to fill me in on kind of how you ended up as the CEO of Cartai. What was your journey to get here?
Mine was a leadership journey. It really started with leadership and then evolved into healthcare. I have to go back to getting into Army ROTC at the University of Arkansas prior to 9/11 before that. And so the world was pretty quiet, and I just kind of took to the whole leadership training, having to get out front, solving problems. And as I kind of went along through that, you know, 9/11 happened, I chose the branch of the Army that I wanted to go into, and that was the Medical Service Corps. And so that was kind of my entry point into the healthcare industry. And when I got out of the Army in 2008, I was able to have some different healthcare leadership jobs, but the whole time was always drawn to, from the time I was in even ROTC in college until now, I've always been drawn to challenging leadership scenarios. And when you pair that with what we have the opportunity to do in healthcare, in putting ourselves in a patient's place, people that are dealing with some very difficult life circumstances, it was just a really good marriage. And so I've really enjoyed it. I've loved it. I love to be able to do what I do.
That's awesome. A lot of people sort of end up in leadership. It sounds like you kind of knew that was the journey you wanted to take. So, from an early age, had you had examples or people in your life that kind of you looked up to, you said, I want to be like this person, and that's kind of the path you went down? Or have you just been a natural born leader your whole life?
It's funny. I don't think I really thought about really being in leadership growing up. And really, even in high school, I guess the end of high school, I started to explore it a little bit. My parents always encouraged all of us as kids, I'm one of four, to find what they would call our red thread, you know, what, going back to our unique wiring, how we're made, and really trying to just encourage that and amplify that. And I think as I was coming out of high school, I wanted to do something adventurous. And I actually ended up in ROTC originally because I wanted to be in the FBI. And so I went to kind of this crazy route to end up, you know, where I ultimately, find myself. But I think, again, through the leadership, through seeing military leadership examples, every time I saw someone else doing it, and it started there, you know, at University of Arkansas, really for me, then it just made me hungry to learn more, to read more, to really pay attention to it. And so that's, I would say that's really where it started, probably when I was 17, 18.
I'm always intrigued by people who have spent time serving our country. Thank you, by the way. And I know you spent some time in Iraq as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the lessons that came out of that from a leadership perspective? And what are some of the things that you've always applied to your life ever since you had the opportunity to serve and be deployed for our country?
I'm very thankful to have gotten the opportunity to do that. I was deployed to Iraq all of 2005. It was actually during that time we were, I was a medical platoon leader, so I had a platoon of 40 medics, worked with a physician and then one physician assistant, and our job was to provide medical support to about an 800-person battalion. And we were really trying to, during some of that time, work with Iraqi Army forces and sometimes train them on some different techniques. And so I enjoyed all that, but there were a lot of parts of that that were not enjoyable, of course. There were some really, really tough situations. Crisis decision-making, I would say, was a key thing that I learned during that time. The Army does a good job of, if you go through officer training, either through a military, you know, school like a West Point or going through traditional ROTC, and just for all positions in the Army, they train getting people to operate at the top of their scope. They train decision-making in crisis situations. And it may be the wrong decision, but you've got to make a decision. And in a deployed environment, specifically in my role as a medical platoon leader, where I knew that, I mean, there were, literally were lives on the line. I mean, it was scary. It was scary doing that even 15 years ago, you know, where I've learned a lot of things since then. But it forced me to be able to maintain a sense of calm, because I had all these medics looking at me, and we had soldiers and other civilians and others that we were caring for at that time, and I knew I had to stay steady in the midst of what felt like sometimes a chaotic environment around me. So I'm thankful for it.
Well, that's an easy segue into the situation we're in right now.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, a lot of leaders in different size and scope of organizations are finding themselves in crisis leadership for the first time in their lives. Some people made it through 2008, 2009 and realized that that was a crisis for their organization. Some have been through independent crisis for their organization. Nobody's been through a crisis like we're in right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to even take a step back about and kind of get your perspective on when you joined Carti and mm-hmm. when you became the CEO of this organization. It was going through a little bit of a tough time even then. And so you kind of stepped in to overcome a crisis for the organization, feel like you're hopefully coming out of it to step right back into one. So talk me through that journey of stepping into an organization that had some work to do. What was that process like?
Crisis one felt completely different from crisis two. The first crisis when I stepped into Carti, I would call it was more of an identity crisis. I'm not meaning to play on that too much, but that's really what it was. It was the organization had gone through a massive period of taking on more and more, more doctors. This wonderful main cancer center where we kind of have our headquarters here in Little Rock, and growing just in the total number of employees, we call them team members here. And so I would say the complexity of the journey was, it changed so rapidly in a matter of a few years, where for the first 35 years of the organization, from 1976 through 2011, it was just what we would call one arm of oncology. And then since that time, got into surgical oncology and medical oncology and imaging services. And so with the complexity came challenges. And again, I already said that that was something that I wanted to lean into, but you've got to go back to the root of what the challenge is, and the foundation is what you have to be able to have. And that started with our culture. And so with this identity crisis, we had to figure out who we are as an organization now, or then at that time in fall of 2017. And so there was a lot of, you know, what's our new vision going to be? Establishment or reestablishment of our values. So it was a different kind of work than this more recent, you know, crisis, coronavirus, this pandemic, because it was all about our discovery of who we are and doing all that hard work, that, which then provided a foundation for us being able to have solid operations and solid financial results. Going into this season, we already had that. We had done that work. And it made a total difference. I actually, you know, looked up, we were a couple of weeks into it. It was in late March, and we were definitely, there were some concerns and we were feeling the effects, but I told my wife, Courtney, I said, this just feels different. It feels different than it did before. And I was so thankful that we had, with all of the physicians and with all the leaders in the team, we'd gone through that hard work the first time 3 years ago, because it allowed us to be able to weather this and weather this really well. And the most important aspect of that is being able to care for patients in the midst of this who were new to cancer. And they didn't have a choice to say, when did I get my cancer diagnosis? So it happened to be during a global pandemic. They just wanted to be able to depend on us. And so that foundational work was so, so important for us. And it was a different kind of feeling. And we felt our team saying that to us. Our physicians said that. And it just made me proud of our organization.
That's awesome. So we find ourselves in this global pandemic, and on a good day, cancer care is a difficult thing. So add on top of that, all the nuances that come with figuring out in a very short period of time, how do we still care for our patients, our team members, and the community around us? What's been one of the biggest challenges that you personally have faced as a leader to figure that out? Because ultimately the weight sort of lies on your shoulders and that of your leadership staff. But, you know, to your point from your military days, you might not always make the best decision, but you have to make a decision. You have to move forward. So what have those challenges been like for you?
We had established a precedent here a few years ago of listening to our physicians and our leadership team at CARTI working hand in hand with them. And as this really ramped up, started, you know, early mid-March, we knew we were already having conversations of, hey, what happens when this hits Arkansas? You know, what are we going to do? And I like to rely on our technical experts. Really, with something like this that's very technical, I would say, in nature, it's actually not a natural strong suit of mine, getting into the granular detail of how is this affecting certain patient types and what are we going to do. And so we developed something here just called our joint operations team, where we get our physician leaders in the same room routinely as our executive leaders here, and we just said, what do you guys think? How do we need to do this? And it made the decision work very easy, because in listening to them, we knew that to be able to protect patients, we had to take care of the ones that were a new cancer diagnosis, the patients that were actively undergoing cancer treatment. Said in short, patients that if they were to step out of one of our cancer centers and say, okay, I'm going to be at the house for a while and avoid any kind of exposure, it would more negatively affect them and their cancer journey. So knowing that, then we could easily determine, okay, well, if this is about protecting those patients, then, you know, maybe routine checkups and follow-ups, we can make some decisions there and maybe delay some of those visits. We can look at it as an organization, how we can protect our team and protect all the patients that are undergoing treatment. And so those are kind of big picture decisions that were easy to make. And then getting into the detail of how we would actually tactically, you know, operationalize that. I just have to point to our team that did just a tremendous job of laying out how we would do that. And once we got some of the big questions answered, you know, how our PPE, our personal protective equipment, screening mechanisms, then it made, again, the administration of that more easy to start.
The biggest reason, I think, for the economic shutdown and everything else was to ensure that the healthcare system doesn't get overwhelmed. Cartier's a part of the healthcare system, but not in a traditional way. You guys have to keep operating at a high level because cancer has no mercy. It doesn't know this global pandemic is happening. It's still affecting people left and right. So how is y'all's organization, how have you led through this time that maybe differs from other healthcare organizations?
In some ways, I would say it's been more challenging. In some ways, it's probably been less challenging. We're not a hospital. We're not. We're kind of a unique setup at Cartai in that we are independent, nonprofit, non-physician owned. We're not under any other hospital or healthcare system. We're not outside managed, and so it's allowed us the freedom and autonomy to be able to make decisions quickly for our patients, to be able to kind of turn on a dime if we need to adjust a process and do that throughout our entire care system throughout the state. But because cancer patients, if they are undergoing active cancer treatment and then they test COVID positive, we knew there were early statistics showing that those patients could be very, very vulnerable to having a real negative outcome. And so that put more on us in terms of, hey, we really got to get this airtight in terms of our screening procedures, in terms of everybody being masked up all the time. But at the same time, speaking to our unique setup, and that one, we're really focusing on one thing. Patients we know have been nervous, and I've heard hospital administrators saying this, you know, they've been nervous in some ways to return to a traditional hospital setting. We've been able to differentiate a little bit in that way. We're an outpatient comprehensive cancer treatment organization, and so being able to kind of separate that out, still protecting an ultra-safe environment, protective environment from our patients, but saying, hey, can we're set up uniquely, you know, different, has worked. And we just want to continue to build on that because we don't know how long this is going to last.
I want to shift gears just a little bit and talk about something that I think is on the minds of a lot of people, especially in leadership these days. You went from being deployed in Iraq and serving in a crisis situation there to moving into a CEO role of a cancer center that had to overcome an identity crisis and then into a pandemic crisis. There's an element of mental toughness that comes along with leading through a crisis. I think a lot of people, it's their breaking point. You either make it or break it during these times. How have you managed to keep that mental clarity to move forward and always be able to lead through these difficult situations?
I mean, I'm human like anybody else. I mean, there are tough days for sure. You know, my daily routine is waking up and starting with a lot of prayer and just asking for clarity and direction and going back to our purpose and what we're here to do. But I would say that, you know, I've been very fortunate to be able to have a team around me here that they're able to all operate at the top of their scope. Those unique gift sets, like I was referencing earlier, a lot of those are very different from mine. And I recognize the value in that. You know, we believe in a concept here. It's part of one of our values called equal value, different function at Cartai. And we know through that regardless of what your role is, you know, what title is on your badge out of our roughly 650 team members, it takes everyone believing in what we're doing and believing that their role is absolutely valuable to make this work. Once we had kind of set, you know, when you talked about kind of some of those hard days in the beginning, and I knew my job was to come in and set the tone. There's nobody else that can do that but me. That's where I feel like I am gifted and I can set a vision and I can do those things. But it takes people believing in it and jumping on board. But every time you get someone else who believes in it, then you build a little bit more momentum and a little bit more momentum. And the best thing I like to see is when we have one of our physicians or someone else standing up, and now they're telling the story. They're talking about who we are and our identity as an organization. And so that just reinvigorates me to like, man, let's go. You know, let's go out and do something else. Let's take this type of world-class cancer care we want to deliver and take it to a brand new area that, you know, has been traditionally underserved for a long time. So there's been a ton of momentum that has happened over the last 3 years, and I'm thankful for those moments. They're memorial stone moments for me.
I love it. I think the clarity and the vision are two things that, as I talk to organizations and different leaders in different capacities, the more clear your vision was going into this as an organization, the easier it is for everybody to know what their role is to move things forward. Would you say that's how it's been for you guys?
Yeah, that's, you know, those were a lot of the conversations early on. We got into a room in September of 2017, and I was standing there with our roughly 25 physicians at the time, and we knew that we had to set a vision that we could build upon. And that vision, very simply put, was to be the cancer treatment destination, not the cancer treatment destination. And through that, when we started building, you know, we determined that, well, how really are we doing that? Well, it's through transforming the way cancer care is delivered and really bridging a gap that we know that exists, especially when it comes to cancer care, of what I call trust and accessibility, pulling those together. Patients are willing to travel for cancer care that they can trust, but they can't always do that. And in today's society especially, everything is about accessibility, whether you're going to the grocery store or shopping on Amazon, or really from our standpoint, from an economic standpoint, there are patients, again, who just, it has to be accessible because that's the only option, because I can't travel. And so people capturing that on this team and speaking that language and being able to say, okay, hey, Adam, this can work in my role, or this can work in my area, and this is how I see this playing out, you know, in business development, from a financial standpoint, how we can model something. I mean, our medical staff, all of these things kind of have contributed to being able to chase that vision.
I love that. And you mentioned transforming cancer care. One of the things I think everybody that knows somebody, or which is all of us, that has gone through cancer, is we wanted to, how can we find a cure faster? Constantly knowing that people are out there researching and creating technologies to innovate the industry. Prior to March 2020, that was probably all you guys were focused on. How can mm-hmm. we bring the newest innovations? But then all of a sudden we have to shift our focus to how do we innovate through a pandemic? So where's the focus right now on innovations within the cancer care industry, and specifically you guys? What are you trying to do to innovate and change the way cancer care is delivered?
You know, when the pandemic hit the United States, you know, hit Arkansas, you know, we were, like you would assume, I mean, that's in our main focus. And we've got to be able to figure this out. Otherwise, we can't focus on any of these other things. I would say that while protecting our patients, our team, against COVID, in the midst of COVID, it's still there, but it's one piece out of many other pieces we need to continue to focus on. I talked to our team kind of at the end of May, beginning of June, our leaders, and said, you know, we've got to, it's not like we can treat COVID as any less important, but we've got to let these other things that we were talking about a couple of months ago go back and rise to the surface. Because again, like you said, cancer goes on. Patients are still getting a diagnosis. There's still patients out there that we know we can touch that we haven't been able to touch yet. And so we started really kind of hitting the gas again on those things and focusing on that. And cancer continues to adapt. I mean, it's aggressive. It hits everybody differently. And we know we can't stop pursuing new innovative treatments and then the way we deliver that.
Through this whole process, through your whole career, really, if you could point to one leadership principle that you feel like can be applied to just about anything, or that has worked well for you in most situations, what would that be?
You know, I wrote down earlier, I was thinking about this, and it's the Peter Drucker, Culture Eats Strategy for Breakfast. And that, I could speak to that principle in Crisis One and Crisis Two. And I love strategy. I love strategy. I've learned over time that I actually have an entrepreneurial spirit, and being able to use any of that with our team, again, in this delivery of cancer care and being able to move faster to get that to patients. I love how those worlds merge. But at the end of the day, if you don't have the cultural foundation as a team to be able to support it, you can't do anything. If you don't have people that believe in what you're doing, they're on the team and they can't communicate that in that delivery of care, and our team members who are supporting that delivery of care, then it's all for naught. It didn't matter.
You mentioned entrepreneurial spirit, and when you look at a building like this, when you talk about something like cancer care that's very, in some ways, I would assume systematic in its approach, obviously very medical-based. Entrepreneurial mindset says, you know, you jump off a cliff and assemble the plane on the way down. That doesn't sound like something you want to bring to a cancer care, but obviously your mindset and the nature of the way you've led through crisis, there's an element of that that you have to do. So do you ever feel like that's kind of the approach you have to take to certain solutions for problems?
I don't ever feel like, you know, we're jumping off of a cliff and having to assemble the plane on the way down. I feel like we've got a really solid plane that we can land, and it can work in a number of different places. I feel like it's evolving. We're constantly learning. I tell our new orientees, I just told them a couple of days ago when I was talking in front of them, I said, this is an imperfect organization, but we believe we have a near perfect vision that we're pursuing. And we are aggressive, but I'm okay with saying that because cancer is aggressive. And we've come out with, even just in some of the ways that we market, you know, and putting up different billboards and cancer hates coming here. And, you know, we came out with a really provocative one, you know, cancer's worst nightmare. And we were thankful working with our ad agency, ERI, on. And we have two different groups that we're dealing with. Cancer affects 1 in 3, and those can be very overwhelming statistics. There are patients that don't have cancer, but have a 1 in 3 chance of getting it in their lifetime. And then we have patients that are already battling cancer. Those potentially are two different messages. We want to absolutely, our first value is compassionate care. That's the C in CARTI. So we know we have to lead with compassion, but we know because cancer adapts, because it's aggressive, we've got to come up constantly with new innovative ways of delivering treatment. We can't wait on the industry to figure out what our next move needs to be. We want to set the tone for what it should look like.
I love that. Okay, so first of all, congratulations on being selected to Arkansas's 40 under 40 class this year, which brings up a very valid point. You're not somebody who's gray-headed and been at this for 40 years and has all the answers. You're somebody that has, in just a handful of short years, taken this thing and run with it. So there's a lot of people out there that I think would love to be in the shoes of running an organization like this before they turn 40 years old. Talk me through just some of the things you do to sharpen yourself, to keep yourself, you know, continuing to move forward, because, you know, like I said, you're playing in a field where generally somebody that's 20 years your senior would have a hard time figuring things out. So you're constantly moving, shaping, and adapting yourself to be the leader you need to be. What are some of those personal tactics that you take daily? Are you a big reader? I know we see each other, used to see each other at the gym. I haven't been in forever, but
I haven't either. it's all at home now.
That's right.
Yes, I am a big reader. There's a, you know, there's a John Maxwell leadership principle that leadership is a process. It develops daily, not in a day. No one ever arrives. And I think everyone has to believe in that as a leader. If you're not constantly developing yourself, call that self-leadership, then you get complacent very quickly. So yeah, I read a lot. Sometimes I'm, you know, I use Audible a lot. And so I'm reading, you know, as my wife says, reading with her ears, you know, as I'm working out. Or I'm always just try to have some kind of book, you know, that I'm picking up. I usually like a combination. But You know, when I first started really getting into leadership, you know, kind of after college, and after I got out of the Army, I mean, it was all just leadership books. Books, you know, that usually had leadership in the title. And there are tons of them out there. And I felt like I couldn't get enough at first. I was just reading those and reading those. And then and you kind of take all this in. And then after a while, you start to figure out the application of all these things. They're nice to have. There are little tidbits that I can call on all the time. But then it was, okay, how did this play out in so-and-so's life? Then, you know, there's a great book by Doris Kearns Goodwin called one is Team of Rivals, which is, you know, Abraham Lincoln was made into a movie. And then there's one that's Leadership in Turbulent Times and talks about four different presidents, you know, and going through decisions that they had to make, good and bad, and the outcome of that. And I've learned a lot through those things because I've definitely made mistakes. I think the key is learning from those things. Is I don't want to be the same that I was a year ago or 2 years ago or 5 years ago. I think we're very prone as human beings just to kind of say, okay, that I'm good. I finished school, you know, or I finished this, or I graduated from something, and so I've got the certificate, you know, on the wall, whatever that is, and you're done. And I think our minds can continue to absorb things, and especially when the stakes are high, we have to keep growing. We have to keep learning.
Is there anything that doesn't come naturally to you or that you have to work a little harder at to apply?
I mentioned earlier, I think just the technical aspect of things. You know, when I started this job, before I started, I thought, you know, I really need to. I had not been in oncology before this. I had spent years in cardiology. I'd been in rehab. I'd been in military healthcare. And I needed to learn about cancer. And so I think I just Googled, you know, books on cancer, and one of the most famous ones, you know, at the time was called The Emperor of All Maladies by a physician named Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, and it's a long book. It's in depth. That one was a good one to read. I read that one actually hardcover, you know, hardback, which was good. I wanted to say, okay, I'll slip this in the office so I can reference it. And then I read another one called The Gene that he also wrote. That one I had to do with the years. That one was a little harder. I needed some encouragement to continue that. But, I mean, it dives into the detail of cancer and how it adapts and different types and obviously getting into genomics and how all that works. You know, that's not necessarily easy reading material, you know, that I would just jump into. But it's important to understand the background. And I would even say appreciate what our team does every single day. And I wanted to be able to appreciate that more, have an appreciation for all of our team members, for our physicians that are kind of in the trenches every day fighting on the behalf of patients.
That's awesome. As I have conversations with people in industries across the board, I always find there's these little nuggets, these little things that you find out about certain industries that you just, they're not generally known to the public. Sometimes that's good stuff. Sometimes that's difficult to kind of comprehend. But is there anything that stands out about your industry that just you think most people don't understand or isn't a common, you know, or is a common misconception maybe about the industry?
I think people would automatically assume, because I had several people tell me this when I came to Carti, that, you know, it's a tough business. It's a hard industry. Not, of course, just healthcare, but when you specifically talk about oncology. And some people would say, oh, man, I could never do that. I could never be a part of that. Because cancer's scary. And the assumption that is correct that people make, at least half of it, is that there are a lot of hard stories. And there are. But there are also aspects where, I mean, it gets really real around here. This is a relationship-based healthcare organization, and it has to be. I mean, there are patients that I still see walking down the sidewalk that were here 3 years ago. There are some, unfortunately, they're not, that, you know, we're saying hello to in the hallway. But there are also these huge stories of hope. We have, even since this pandemic, you know, we have a bell ringing ceremony. We were doing this, of course, before the pandemic, but this is your completion of treatment. Get to ring the bell. It's a celebration. Get to give, you know, your therapist a hug. Give, nurse taking care of you, your physician, and we haven't been able to have all of the family and visitors in here. And so what family and friends started doing is just lining up out on the road, and they started honking their horns. And, you know, the patient may be able to go out on the balcony and see them or be able to walk out. And so there are some real celebratory moments. We know that we get to be able to be part of, when I mention memorial stones or a milestone in someone's life, and that's really special. And I know that part is something, I'm thinking about this, that not everyone focuses on, but I've got a very good friend named Joel Sengoga, who's a really wise man, and he just says life is a mix. And this business that we're in is a mix, but we embrace that and we appreciate that.
That's great. What was your biggest eye-opener when you transitioned from cardiology to oncology?
I think, as I was mentioning, just the relationship-based part of this. I remember seeing patients in cardiology that I may have seen in the hallway, you know, hey, Mr. Smith, you know, hey, Ms. Jones, that, you know, saw you last year for a follow-up, you know, or procedure. Here, there are patients that I see and you're seeing every single week. And there's just something that is more, you have the opportunity to build something more in depth. I had a patient who, it just kind of happened, you know, became a friend, you know, early on in my journey here and actually late in his journey here. And our paths crossed and we got to know each other and we'd actually end up sitting down and talking routinely. And I mentioned getting real. He got really real with me and shared just what it was like and what he was facing. He had a glioblastoma. It's a brain tumor. And it was inoperable. And we used to sit down and talk about that. And, you know, he had several kids like I do. And so we were able to relate on a level that was powerful. And he would just sit here and talk like we're talking. But I know he was also at the same time facing this massive thing in his life. And it reinforced for me that this can be a powerful place, that this is a powerful place, that it's different. And even though that's hard in those relationships, we have to continue to do it. You know, we can't stop doing that. That's one of the beautiful things that we get to experience with patients and families here.
There's a phrase that I haven't been able to experience too often, but every once in a while it hits me hard, and that phrase is, it's lonely at the top. And so a lot of times when you're leading an organization and you feel the weight and the pressure of the decision making and the vision casting and all the things that you and you alone have the responsibility to do, there's not really anybody to share in that. So who do you surround yourself with to kind of continue to sharpen you and ensure that you've got some sort of horizontal peers in your circle?
Yeah, I've got a couple of good friends, you know, that I can talk to. I've got a leadership coach that's not even in this state. He has what he termed a different people architecture than I have. And so that's one of the tough things, especially being in Arkansas, is everybody knows everybody. And so you almost got to get outside of that a little bit to be able to get into, you know, how the worlds merge of the pressures, you know, that can and I would say should be felt anytime you're in a position of leadership. But I firmly believe, you know, there's actually a lot of leadership theory on that concept of it's lonely at the top. And I've even read some people who say, well, it shouldn't be lonely at the top, you know. And I would actually say, you know, it's meant to be that way. It's just part of it. Because every time you take on greater levels of responsibility, you naturally can take on, you know, things like misunderstanding in the journey and all that. And I preach this message to our leaders when they're in a room and just say, this is part of it. You know, this is part of what you're doing. And create an atmosphere where our leaders can talk, because everybody needs that. They need to be able to kind of get outside of their day-to-day and say, hey, are you dealing with this problem? Yeah, are you dealing with this? It can be a really healing thing. You know, it can be encouraging to continue to move forward.
I love that. So that being said, who are some of the titans in your own life, the people that you look up to and that you've learned from and that you kind of can look back on and say, you know what, without their help, without their support, I wouldn't be where I am?
You know, I'd have to start with my dad. My mom and dad, but I've always, through a lot of this journey, frequently call him, and he knows, and he's continued to refine this. He always knows exactly what to say, at what point. And I can remember, even through the Army and coming out and making decisions that, he'd kind of let me talk and let me run with something. And then he'd kind of calmly say, well, have you thought about this? And so that's an ongoing thing. Others that I would mention, some obviously are not living. I've read this story a lot of the leadership of Nehemiah of the Bible, roughly 450 BC. I mean, it's a story of rebuilding, and I love that. Abraham Lincoln, I talked about team of rivals and surrounding yourself with people that aren't necessarily just like you, but to be able to accomplish something that's beyond all of you, what I call a transcendent purpose. I love the spirit and the energy and the stories of Theodore Roosevelt. I've read a lot about him. I mean, he just lived a crazy, wild life of doing all this stuff, and it's only roughly 60 years. When you look at just kind of innovation and industry, I like reading about, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, we're doing something completely different, and I could go on, but there's a lot. I think you have to be able to learn from others.
I'm curious about this because I guess I've just never inquired about it, but is what Kartai is doing, is this a model that you guys are using from other states, from other people, or is this a model unique to itself?
I don't want to go as far as to say that everything we're doing is unique. I would say that what I've learned over 3 years is that our organization, the way that we're set up, the way that we're organized, again, I mentioned this earlier, but being an independent, nonprofit, non-physician-owned, non-outside-managed, all that, but being outpatient and comprehensive in our care, that's unique. The way that we want to deliver it, I believe, is unique. Now, are there methods that we use in immunotherapy, that is being used a lot now over the last 5 years since it really was starting to come out? I mean, are there other types of care methods, with genomics that we're doing, others are doing this? Yes. But I believe the way that we're trying to push out that care, that merging those worlds of accessibility and trust and leaning into that, from what I see, seems to be unique. There's a lot of, just in healthcare in general, I would say there can be a lot of just kind of listening to kind of the same ideas and thoughts. That because, I get sent probably 10 different webinars a day. Listen to this. This is how the latest industry is doing this. This is how you're doing this. And I don't want to say, it sounds arrogant to say that they're all bad. I don't believe that they are. I don't particularly enjoy that part as much because, it feels like a lot of kind of the same stuff. And I think to be able to really attack cancer the way that we want to with our vision, it's got to be different. It's got to be something that's new in the approach. So those are the things that really interest me.
Love it. All right, I want to move into some kind of quick hit questions. Just some real quick things. We've maybe even addressed a few of these, but what's on your Audible right now? What are you listening to or reading right now? What's your kind of most current book?
I've read a lot of, a combination of things. Patrick Lencioni, there's a few different books. There are a handful that he's written that I've been listening to. Dr. Henry Cloud, books about relationship stuff. He's got several, Boundaries for Leaders, Never Go Back. I mentioned a couple of those other ones by Doris Kearns. There's another author that I like named Gene Edwards. He's got a book, Tale of Three Kings, that I've read like three times that I really enjoy. Those are a few.
Love it. Daily routine, what do you have to do every single day?
I have become a coffee drinker. I never...
So this is a new thing?
This is a new thing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I thought it was a prerequisite to work in the healthcare industry. You have to be a coffee drinker.
That's... apparently it's a prerequisite for either, you know, getting through school or being in the Army. Didn't start any of those times. Yeah, I was on an anniversary trip a couple of years ago and was talking to my wife, like, hey, you want to try some coffee? The bed and breakfast, and every day. Yeah, coffee, like to get up and read, pray, like to work out in the mornings. I feel like it just helps to sharpen me a little bit. I like to be able to come in bright-eyed, you know, not feeling like I'm dragging. So I like to have accomplished a lot before I really walk in. And honestly, that's when I do a lot of my best thinking. I'm a morning person for sure. And so as I'm walking in, I feel like maybe I've already solved a lot of things in my mind. So that work day, that time is valuable from the moment I wake up. It starts to kind of peter off a little bit, you know, in the afternoon.
I love it. All right, best piece of advice you've ever given or received?
I really think going back to what my parents reinforced in me about just unique wiring, and then my leadership coach, Jay, what he really reinforced is that everybody is born with just unique, I call it wiring, unique gifts and abilities. And coming to understand those better in myself, and then appreciating those and understanding those, or trying to understand those in others, whether that's my kids, my wife, family, friends, and here and the team around me, that's been a really good thing to understand and appreciate. There's not a one size fits all approach to, I feel like, life or leadership. Everybody's looking at things through different eyes.
I love that. Other than coffee, is there a relatively new formed habit, good or bad?
You know, I've been on a peanut butter kick for a long time. If you were going to ask me what my favorite food is, I would be answering that as well. I eat a lot of peanut butter. I hope I've tried to read about it a little bit, because I got nervous one day that I was consuming so much of it that it would have a negative impact. I think I asked one of our oncologists, like, you know, because people could say, like, man, oh, this causes cancer, this causes cancer. Like, what if you eat a jar of peanut butter every 3 days? Is that bad? But that's definitely part of my life.
So you're a peanut butter addict. That's interesting.
I am.
Because quick side story. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to go interview Doug McMillon, the CEO of Walmart, at his house in Bentonville. And he was so great and efficient and professional. He drove up in his Jeep with the doors off and hops out, comes inside, says hi to his wife, does the perfect amount of small talk, you know, nice 30-second small talk, make you feel like you're the only person in the room, which we kind of were. But, you know, and then he's like, let's get to it. We sit down, prepping for a 30-minute interview. He was done in 7 minutes because he just nailed everything. Perfect soundbite. It was great, right?
There it is.
And then he proceeds to walk into the kitchen, because this was on his lunch break, and he goes to the pantry, pulls out a loaf of bread and a jar of peanut butter, and makes himself a peanut butter sandwich, pours himself a glass of milk, kisses his wife goodbye, hops back in the Jeep, and back to the office. And I was like, this was the most normal lunch break for one of the top CEOs in the world. And so there must be something about peanut butter and
it works.
Organizations that I need to eat more peanut butter. I love that. Okay, if you were to write your own book, so you're a big book fanatic, what would the title be?
Give Me the Hill Country.
Texas Hill Country?
No.
Okay.
More of a metaphor.
Okay.
You know, I use this as kind of a... It goes back to, you know, Old Testament times with the Israelites, when Joshua and Caleb is an old man. He's one of the ones with Joshua that wanted to take on a land of giants, and he's an old man, and they're saying, okay, you can have whatever inheritance, you know, you want. Where do you want it? He's 80 years old and says, give me the really tough situation. You know, give me the hill country.
I love that. That's great. And a lot of thought has gone into that, clearly. You're ready to go.
I have thought
you're ready
about
to write this book.
I've written a couple of lines.
Okay, good. Well, I can't wait to read the whole thing, maybe in a year or two, right?
I don't know, or longer.
All right. When you're not listening to books, what are you jamming out to? Who's your favorite musician, artist, band?
Stuff that's going to kind of, you know, if I'm working out in the morning, it's going to be something completely different, but generally speaking, if it's, you know, going to be grilling outside or riding the car, it's going to be stuff that's a little more relaxing. I'm still a Pandora guy. I pay for the premium, you know, so it's commercial free.
Yeah.
And then I thumbs up to perfection. Paolo Nutini.
Okay.
James Morrison, Sarah Groves, Van Morrison, some John Mayer. I mean, just generally just easy stuff. I like to play guitar a little bit, so I can try to play some of the stuff, and that's a little bit of a it's relaxing, you know, takes stress level down.
Love that. We've kind of already hit the favorite food with peanut butter, but when you're not eating peanut butter, where are you going to dinner? What are you grilling out? What's your go-to?
Here in town, as far as restaurants?
Yeah.
You know, I like Capers.
It's a great place.
Probably seafood is my favorite. I love fish.
Mm.
So, yeah, I really enjoy that. And they really know how to make fish there. It's good.
Love it. All right, Adam, any last words, anything people can do to find out more about what you guys are doing here, be part of the mission, anything like that?
Hey, just go to cartie.com. We've got a brand new website that's up and running that I love, because all the stuff that we've been talking about, you know, the kind of going back to the identity and the language of who we are, you see that. You see us, who we are, you know, our physicians, our team, and where we are. You know, we know that it's a tough business, but we're equally excited about the future.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank
you. Really appreciate you coming out, telling us all your awesome leadership principles, and just for being a titan of cancer care.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Nate.
If you liked this episode of Titans of Industry, head to contenttitan.co/podcast for more episodes, or subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. If you know of an industry titan that's doing amazing things, let us know on social media or through our website so we can tell their story. Thanks for listening.